At Audi Columbus, luxury meets convenience. Family-owned since 1897, we've built our reputation on trust, transparency, and innovation. Browse our selection online and complete your purchase from home. Then simply stop by to pick up your keys.
During the season of Audi, drive home a new 2025 Audi Q5 for $599 for 36 months with $4506 down.
The next generation shops online. Experience the future with us at AudiColumbus.com. Buyers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
See dealer for details. Offer ends 12/125.
It's the Red Tag Sales Event at Jeff Weiler Chevrolet of Columbus. Look for the red tags and unlock unbeatable discounts on new and pre-owned Chevys. 0% APR on select new Chevrolet for well-qualified buyers. From the rugged Silverado to the sleek Malibu, every tag means savings. Financing made easy. We'll pay off your trade no matter what you owe. Stop by Jeff Weiler Chevrolet on Gender Road or shop anytime at jeffweilercolumbus.com. That's jeffweilercolumbus.com.
Hey there, curious minds and fellow knowledge seekers. Welcome back to The Deep Dive.
It's great to be here.
We're the show where we take complex information, sift through it, and pull out the most important, often surprising insights just for you. Today, we're embarking on a crucial journey, one that touches almost everyone's daily life, yet often remains a bit of a mystery, the Texas Transportation Code.
That's right. It's a vast and, frankly, pretty detailed body of law. But our mission today is to cut through the legal jargon. We're going to give you a clear roadmap, extracting those essential nuggets of knowledge from the Texas Highway Patrol's BPOC student manual.
Think of it as a shortcut, maybe, a way to get truly well-informed about the rules of the road in Texas, even if you've never, you know, cracked open a law book before.
Exactly. We'll be breaking down foundational definitions, exploring vehicle registration and licensing, unpacking the core rules of driving, touching on equipment requirements, and delving into what happens when collisions occur. And the goal isn't just to tell you what the law says. It's about why it matters, giving you those aha moments that make the information truly stick.
So if you've ever wondered about the difference between a public place and a private one for traffic stuff, or why your truck's weight rating impacts your license,
or even those subtle things that determine legal responsibility after a crash.
Yeah, then you are definitely in for a treat. We'll answer questions that might seem simple, but actually have pretty significant implications.
We're aiming to help you understand the core principles so you can navigate the roads and the legal landscape with, well, more confidence.
Okay, let's do it. Let's unpack this blueprint of Texas traffic law by setting the scene, foundational legal concepts. All right, to kick off our deep dive, let's tackle a concept that sounds straightforward but actually has critical legal implications for enforcement. What exactly counts as a public place under the Texas Transportation Code? It seems obvious, but I guess the legal definition is key.
That's an excellent starting point, honestly. Because so many common traffic offenses, they're only enforceable if they happen in what the law defines as a public place. According to our source material, a public place is broadly defined as any place to which the public or a substantial group of the public has access.
Okay.
So this isn't just about, you know, publicly owned roads. It includes streets, highways, sure, but also the common areas of schools, hospitals, apartment buildings, office buildings, transport facilities, shops.
So the key isn't really who owns the land.
Exactly. It's about whether the general public has access to it.
So like a big box store parking lot that's usually private property, but...
Right. That's often considered a public place for traffic law purposes because the general public has, you know, free access. You can just drive right in. And this distinction is vital because specific serious offenses like driving while intoxicated, DUI for minors, reckless driving, those must occur in a public place for law enforcement to take action under those specific laws.
Ah, I see. So if someone's driving drunk on their own private ranch, way out where nobody else can go,
then those specific DWI laws might not apply in the same way. Also, motor vehicle crashes. They're only considered reportable crashes by law enforcement if they occur in a public place.
So that parking lot crash might be reportable, but one in my driveway wouldn't be.
Generally, that's right. It really defines the boundary, the scope of where certain critical laws apply and where official enforcement actions like writing a formal crash report can be taken.
Okay, now for something a bit more serious, but really crucial for understanding fault in fatal crash investigations, let's talk about the difference between manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. People often confuse them, right? But the legal definitions, especially regarding the driver's mindset, are worlds apart.
Absolutely. This gets into the core of legal responsibility. It moves beyond just what happened to why it happened from a legal standpoint. Both involve a death caused by someone's actions, obviously. But the core difference is the culpable mental state of the person involved, as defined back in the penal code. It's about what they knew, or importantly, what they should have known.
Okay, so let's break that down. What does that mean for manslaughter? What's the mental state there?
For manslaughter, under the penal code, the culpable mental state is recklessly.
Recklessly, okay.
This means a person is aware of, but consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk.
Aware, but disregards it anyway.
Exactly. That conscious disregard is the key. And the risk has to be significant, so significant that ignoring it is a gross deviation from the standard of care that an ordinary person would exercise.
Hmm.
This charge comes up a lot in fatal crash investigations, and it's very serious. It's a second-degree felony. You can think of it like knowing you're doing something really dangerous, but sort of thinking, eh, I'll risk it.
That idea of conscious disregard is fascinating. Let's use an example from the source material to make it clearer. Imagine Jim is traveling 60 mph in a 60 mph zone, but the roadway is wet and he hits a patch of standing water. His vehicle hydroplanes, leaves the road, rolls over. Jim's passenger is killed. Would Jim likely have committed manslaughter here?
Based on that scenario alone, the source suggests probably no.
Really? Even though his passenger died?
Well, while his actions caused a death, his driving itself 60 in a 60 on a wet road might not be seen as a gross deviation. And crucially, he was likely not consciously aware that his specific driving behavior posed that substantial, unjustifiable risk in that exact moment. Hydroplaning can happen unexpectedly.
Mm.
Without more, like extreme speed or other reckless acts, it probably doesn't meet that conscious disregard standard for manslaughter. The focus is on his awareness of the risk from his driving, not just the terrible outcome.
Okay, that makes sense. So then how does criminally negligent homicide or CNH differ? What's the mental state if it's not conscious disregard?
With criminally negligent homicide, the mental state is criminal negligence. And here, the standard shifts. It's not about consciously disregarding a risk you know about. Instead, it's about whether you ought to be aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk. You failed to perceive a risk that an ordinary person would have perceived.
Ah, so it's about what you should have known.
Precisely.
Mm.
And that failure to perceive the risk must also be a gross deviation from the standard of care. It's also common in fatal crashes, and it's a state jail felony. The focus shifts to what a reasonable, ordinary person would have foreseen in those circumstances.
Okay, this next example for Jim really highlights that difference, I think. Jim is speeding while texting and driving in the rain on tires with extremely poor tread. Jim's passenger is killed in the crash. Now, is that criminally negligent homicide?
In this scenario, the answer is likely yes.
Why the difference?
Because the combination of factors changes everything. Speeding, plus texting, plus rain, plus bald tires. Jim absolutely should have known that this combination posed a substantial and unjustifiable risk to his passenger. His failure to perceive that obvious compounded risk that would likely be considered a gross deviation from ordinary care.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole picture. Even if he wasn't thinking, I'm consciously disregarding this specific risk, the negligence is clear from the totality of his actions.
So the core difference boils down to aware of and disregards for manslaughter versus ought to be aware of for criminally negligent homicide. Consciously ignoring a known danger versus failing to see a danger an ordinary person would have seen.
Exactly. It's a subtle distinction legally, but it shows how the law tries to assess the driver's mindset, not just the action, in assigning responsibility for these tragic events. And the penalties reflect that difference. Two, getting on the road. Vehicle registration, licensing, and permits.
Okay, moving from those very serious concepts to something more everyday, but still essential, getting your vehicle registered, a basic requirement for pretty much everyone driving in Texas.
Right, and the general rule laid out in Chapter 502 of the Transportation Code, it's quite clear. When you buy a vehicle or when you become a Texas resident, you typically have 30 days to get your motor vehicle, trailer, or semi-trailer registered.
30 days? That's a key time frame.
It is. And basically, any vehicle you see rolling down a Texas road is presumed to need registration, unless there's a specific legal exception.
And where does that little registration sticker, the insignia, actually go? Because I feel like I see them in different places sometimes.
Yeah, that can be confusing.
Yeah.
For most cars and trucks, it goes on the inside of the windshield.
Okay.
But for motorcycles, for trailers, and for vehicles with a special machinery license plate, the registration insignia must be displayed on the rear license plate.
So a motorcycle with the sticker on the windshield, that's actually wrong.
Technically, yes. That would be improperly displayed, even if the registration is current. The placement matters.
Okay, good to know. What about expired tags? If you see a car with an expired sticker, is that an immediate violation the second it expires? Or is there a little leeway?
There's actually a little leeway, which surprises a lot of people. According to the code, the offense of operation of vehicle with expired license plate doesn't technically happen until after the fifth business day following the expiration date.
Five business days. Okay, so a small grace period.
A small one, yes. But, and this is important, if your registration is expired for more than a year, enforcement usually shifts to operating an unregistered vehicle, which is a more serious offense. Don't let it lapse that long.
Are there any vehicles out there that just aren't registered at all but are still perfectly legal on Texas highways? Thinking of really specialized stuff.
Yes, there are some interesting exceptions. For instance, power sweepers, those big street sweeping machines. They generally aren't registered. If a vehicle meets that specific legal definition, it can operate on highways without plates or a sticker, as long as it's only being used, you know, as a power sweeper.
Huh. Okay. What about farm equipment? You see all sorts of things out in rural areas. How does the code handle farm trailers specifically?
That's a great example because the rules for certain farm vehicles can get pretty detailed, especially for trailers. Many don't need full registration. For farm trailers, it really depends on their weight and how they're used specifically, whether they're being operated temporarily on the highways for farm-related purposes. Basically, it breaks down like this. Farm trailers with a gross weight of 4,000 pounds or less. Generally, they don't need registration or license plate at all.
Okay, the really light ones.
Right. Then those between 4,000 pounds and 34,000 pounds gross weight, they do need a special farm trailer license plate, but still not full registration like a regular trailer.
Got it. Special plate, but not full registration.
But if a farm trailer weighs more than 34,000 pounds gross weight, it's too heavy for the farm trailer plate. It needs normal, full trailer registration. One helpful thing, though. Farm trailers are exempt from state inspection requirements, no matter their weight. That simplifies things a bit for farmers.
So weight is the big factor for farm trailers, determining whether they need no plate, a special plate, or a regular plate. That's pretty specific. What about people just moving to Texas? How long do they have to register their cars?
If you're a non-resident, you can drive here using your valid home state registration for a while. But once you officially become a Texas resident, that reciprocity ends after 30 days. At that point, your vehicles need Texas registration.
30 days for the car registration. Okay.
Now, besides standard registration, Texas also has permits for temporary vehicle operations. These are important for certain situations, right?
Yes, absolutely. These temporary permits cover situations where full registration isn't needed or maybe isn't possible yet. For example, you've got 72-hour or 144-hour permits. These are typically for temporary use of commercial vehicles, trailers, or buses.
And the key things to remember there are the vehicle must have insurance, financial responsibility, and it must pass a state inspection before you can get the permit and hit the road.
No grace period on those either.
None. Yeah. Once that permit expires, the vehicle is considered unregistered, plain and simple.
Okay. What about the other types, the trip permits?
Right. You also have one trip or 30-day trip permits. These let you operate an otherwise unregistered vehicle, maybe to move it for repairs or sale. Again, if you operate outside the specific scope of that permit, like going beyond the single trip or past the 30 days, the vehicle is considered unregistered. The 30-day permit also has weight limits and requires an inspection. Each permit serves a very specific, limited purpose.
Okay, let's talk about buying a car. You drive off the dealership lot. What are the rules for those tags, the temporary ones?
Yeah, this causes a lot of confusion. First, you might see dealer's license plates on cars at the dealership. Those are the metal plates. They belong to the dealer, not a specific car, and are used for demos or maybe the dealer's personal use. One plate displayed on the rear.
Got it. But what about the paper ones we see on cars people have just bought?
Okay, there are two main types of paper tags to know. First, dealer's temporary tags. These have very limited uses, much more restricted than the metal plates. And importantly, law enforcement can now run the number on these tags and get vehicle-specific info from a database.
Ah, so they're trackable now.
Much more so, yes. It helps cut down on misuse.
And the tag the buyer gets, the one you drive home with.
That's the buyer's temporary tag. A dealer can issue only one per sale, and it's valid for no more than 60 days.
Only one? What if my real plates don't arrive in 60 days?
This is a key point. Getting a second buyer's tag after the first expires is actually a violation. If your permanent registration isn't sorted out by then, you need to get a different kind of temporary permit, like that 30-day trip permit we mentioned. You can't just keep using buyer tags indefinitely.
Okay, that's really important to know. And how does that buyer tag need to be displayed? I see them flapping around, taped inside windows.
That's a definite no-no. The law is very clear. The tag must be displayed in the rear license plate area, and the entire temporary tag must be visible and legible at all times, even when the car is moving.
So if it's rolled up or obscured by the wind?
That's an improperly displayed tag, and it's a violation. And while the dealer has to put it on correctly initially, the responsibility shifts to the driver once you leave the lot. It's on you to make sure it stays visible and legible. Oh, and you also need to get a state inspection within 180 days of that tag being issued.
Good to know. Okay, let's shift from the car itself to the driver. What are the basics of driver's licenses in Texas? It's more than just the card, right?
Absolutely. The transportation code uses a license, not just as the physical card, but as the privilege to operate a motor vehicle granted by the state.
The privilege.
Right. And that privilege can be suspended or revoked even if you don't have a physical license. And most of these traffic laws apply when you're operating on a highway. Remember that broad definition. Any publicly maintained way open for public travel, paved, unpaved, big, small. If it's public, it's likely a highway under the law.
So, bottom line, you need a license, that privilege, to drive on a Texas highway, unless you fit a specific exemption. What about people new to the state? We mentioned 30 days for car registration. What about the license?
Correct. For new residents, there's a different time frame. You have 90 days to get a Texas driver's license, assuming you're 16 or older, and have a valid license from your previous state.
90 days for the license, 30 for the car registration? Okay. Yeah. Important distinction.
Definitely don't mix those up.
Now, let's tackle something that often confuses people. License classifications. Class A, B, C, M. How does this work, especially for bigger vehicles? What determines the class you need?
The absolute key here is the gross vehicle weight rating, GVWR, and the gross combination weight rating, GCWR.
GVWR and GCWR.
These are the weights set by the manufacturer, usually found on a sticker on the vehicle door jamb. It's these ratings that determine the license class needed, not the actual weight of the vehicle on any particular day. That's a critical point.
So it's about the vehicle's potential weight capacity, not its current load.
Exactly. Here's a simplified breakdown. Class C. This covers your standard cars and light trucks, specifically single vehicles under 26,001 pounds GVWR, or combinations where the truck is under 26,001 pounds GVWR and the trailer is 10,000 pounds GVWR or less. Also covers small buses, 23 passengers or fewer. Class B. This is for heavier single vehicles, those with a GVWR of 26,001 pounds or more, or buses designed for 24 or more passengers. With a Class B, you can tow trailers 10,000 pounds GVWR or less. Class A. This is for the big rigs. It's required for combinations where the GCWR is 26,001 pounds or more, and the trailer being towed has a GVWR of more than 10,000 pounds.
Okay, and what about motorcycles?
Yes. Class M is specifically for motorcycles.
Got it. So a quick rule for single vehicles, not towing anything heavy.
Right. If it's just a single truck or bus, you never need a Class A. If its GVWR is 26,001 pounds or more, where it seats 24 plus M, you need a Class B. Everything smaller falls under Class C.
Okay, let's test that with your example. I have a pickup truck. GVWR 18,000 pounds. I'm towing a travel trailer. GVWR 9,000 pounds. What license do I need? The total is 27,000 pounds, which is over 26,001. But the trailer is under 10,000.
That combination would require a Class B non-CDL.
Class B, why not C or A?
Okay, let's walk through it. The combination weight rating is over 26,001 pounds, so a Class C isn't enough. But to need a Class A, the trailer itself must have a GVWR over 10,000 pounds. Your trailer is only 9,000 pounds GVWR?
So because the trailer isn't heavy enough, it doesn't trigger the Class A requirement.
Precisely. You need to look at the rating of the power unit and the rating of the towed unit individually, as well as the combination rating. It's those manufacturer ratings that dictate the license, not what you happen to be hauling today.
That's a really important clarification. Okay, what about younger drivers under 18 or people whose licenses have been suspended?
For drivers under 18, there are specific rules. Minimum age is 15. You need driver's ed, things like that. They start with a learner license or instruction permit.
Right, the permit.
And the crucial rule for the learner license is supervision. They must have a licensed adult, 21 or older, with at least 1 year of driving experience, sitting awake and alert in the front seat next to them. And get this. The supervisor can actually get a ticket if they are intoxicated or, say, texting, preventing them from properly supervising. the responsibility is shared.
Wow. Okay. And if your main license gets suspended, are you just grounded, or is there any way to drive legally for essentials?
You're not necessarily completely grounded. You might be eligible for an occupational license.
Occupational, like for work.
Exactly. Or for other essential needs. This is a special license granted by a judge after your regular license is suspended. You have to petition the court and prove an essential need, driving for work, school, or maybe essential household duties like groceries or medical appointments. If the judge approves, they issue a court order. This order is your occupational license for the first 45 days. It spells out exactly when you can drive, where you can drive, why you can drive. It's very specific. Mm-hmm. Might require an ignition interlock device too. And you absolutely must carry a certified copy of that court order with you whenever you're driving under its authority.
What if you violate those very specific restrictions? Say you drive outside the allowed times.
That's a big mistake. Violating any restriction on that court order, or even just failing to have the certified order with you, is a Class B misdemeanor. And a conviction for that means your occupational license is immediately revoked. The privilege is very conditional.
And what kind of things lead to a license suspension in the first place?
Yeah.
Beyond DWI, what else triggers an automatic suspension from DPS?
DPS automatically suspends licenses for several reasons. Driving while your license is already suspended is one. Being labeled a habitually reckless or negligent operator,
right,
that's defined as getting 4 or more moving violation convictions in 12 months, or 7 or more in 24 months.
Wow, that adds up fast.
It can. Also, letting someone else unlawfully use your license, getting convicted of certain offenses in other states, or causing a serious crash, and racing on a public highway. That's an automatic 1-year suspension plus community service. Definitely a no-go.
So even if you don't physically have a license card, your privilege to drive can be suspended. And driving then means you're committing driving while license invalid, DWLI.
Absolutely. DWLI starts as a Class C misdemeanor usually, but it can get enhanced. It bumps up to a Class B misdemeanor if you have a prior DWLI conviction, or if you're caught driving without insurance while suspended, or if the original suspension was for a DWI-related offense. It can even become a Class A misdemeanor if your license is invalid and you don't have insurance and you cause a crash resulting in serious bodily injury or death. The consequences stack up significantly. And yes, even if you never got a license in the first place, if your privilege to obtain one is suspended, you can still be charged with DWLI. It's about the privilege, not the plastic. 4V, rules of the road, operating a vehicle safely and legally.
Okay, we've got our car registered. We've got our license sorted out. Now let's hit the road, metaphorically speaking. What are the core rules for actually operating a vehicle on Texas roads according to Chapter 545?
Right, Chapter 545 lays out the fundamental rules of the road, most basic one. Driving on the right side of the roadway. Pretty straightforward, you generally have to stay on the right half. Obvious exceptions apply, like when you're passing someone or going around an obstruction or on a one-way street. And the law also specifically says slower traffic needs to keep right to let faster traffic pass.
That slower traffic keep right rule? That's actually law, not just courtesy.
It's in the code, yes. Now, what about the shoulder? I see people using it like an extra lane sometimes, especially in traffic jams. Is that ever okay? Generally, driving on the improved shoulder is prohibited. But there are very specific limited circumstances where it is allowed. The source gives a helpful acronym, SAD, PAPA. But the reasons include things like stopping, standing, or parking, accelerating to merge, decelerating for a right turn, passing a vehicle that stopped, slowing or turning left, allowing a faster vehicle to pass, if a sign tells you to, or, crucially, to avoid a collision.
SAD, Papapana. Okay, so not for just bypassing traffic.
Definitely not. And the rules for the left shoulder are even tighter. Emergency vehicles and bicycles, though, they're generally exempt.
Okay. And staying within your lane seems obvious, but you mentioned a nuance earlier.
Right. The law on driving on a laned roadway says you have to drive, as nearly as practical, entirely within a single lane, and you can't move from that lane unless you can do it safely.
The key word is and.
Exactly. Case law has clarified this. Just touching the line or momentarily drifting over it isn't necessarily a violation unless that movement was also unsafe. Both conditions have to be met. Leaving the lane and doing it unsafely.
Interesting. So a minor drift might not be enough for a stop on its own. Now, can an officer stop you if you haven't actually broken a traffic law, but they're just concerned?
Yes, that's possible under the community caretaker doctrine. This recognizes that police have a duty beyond just enforcement. They also have a role to help people who appear to be in distress or danger. Texas courts look at several factors. How distressed does the person seem? Are they somewhere isolated? Are they alone? Do they pose a danger to themselves or others if not helped? If a reasonable officer believes assistance is needed based on these factors, they may be able to stop someone even without observing a specific violation. It's about public safety.
Okay. What about motorcycles? There was some debate about lane use, right? Like riding side by side or between cars.
Yes, and a recent law clarified this. Motorcycle operation rules state that operators are entitled to the full use of a lane. Cars can't crowd them or try to share the lane.
Full lane. Got it.
They're allowed to ride two abreast, two side by side in one lane, but no more than two.
And lane splitting, weaving between cars.
That is explicitly prohibited in Texas.
Yeah.
Operating a motorcycle between lanes of traffic moving in the same direction or passing a car within the same lane is not allowed. It's a clear safety rule here.
All right, let's talk intersections where roads meet and sometimes cars do too. What are the rules for turning? And what counts as an intersection?
Good point of the definition. An intersection is legally defined as the junction of two highways. It specifically excludes private driveways or alleys joining a highway. For right turns, the rule is to approach and make the turn as closely as practicable to the right-hand curb or edge. Think tight, close to the curb. For left turns, you approach in the far left lane legally available for your direction. After entering the intersection, you turn left to arrive in a lane that's authorized for travel in your new direction. You have a bit more choice on the landing lane for lefts. And of course, all turns have to be made safely.
And turn signals. When exactly do you have to use them? Just for turning corners?
Not just for turning. Signaling turns is legally required in three specific situations. One, signaling your intent to turn right or left. And you have to signal continuously for the last 100 feet before the turn. Two, signaling your intent to change lanes. No specific distance here, but you need to signal before you start moving over. Three, signaling your intent to start from a parked position alongside the highway. Case law also clarifies. Just following a curve in the road, not legally a turn requiring a signal, merging from a lane that ends without crossing lines, also not a turn. It's about actively changing your path.
Okay. What about right-of-way if there are no signs or signals? An open intersection. Who goes first?
At an open intersection, the rules prioritize safety and flow. Generally, smaller roads yield to bigger roads. Undivided roads yield to divided highways. Unpaved roads yield to paved roads and must stop first. If none of those apply and two vehicles arrive at roughly the same time, the vehicle on the left must yield to the vehicle on the right.
Left yields to right. Okay. And the move over law, we hear about it a lot. Can you break down exactly what's required?
Yes. The move over slow down law is crucial for protecting people working on the roadside. When you approach a stationary emergency vehicle with lights flashing, or a tow truck with flashing lights, or a TXDOT or maintenance vehicle, unless there's a barrier separating you, you have two options. One, vacate the lane closest to that vehicle, if possible, and safe on a multi-lane road. That's the preferred action. Two, if you can't safely move over, you must slow down to at least 20 miles per hour below the posted speed limit. You have a choice, but you must do one or the other. Violations get progressively more expensive, and if someone gets hurt because you didn't move over or slow down, it can become a very serious charge, even a felony.
Railroad crossings, always a bit nerve-wracking. What are the specific rules there?
The number one rule, always yield to trains. They can't stop quickly. A vehicle approaching a crossing must stop, not closer than 15 feet, not farther than 50 feet from the nearest rail if any warning is active. That means flashing lights, a lowering gate, a flagger, an audible train horn within about 1,500 feet, or if you can plainly see a train that poses a hazard.
15 to 50 feet, that's a specific zone.
Yes. And you have to stay stopped until it's clearly safe to go.
Are there extra rules for buses, school buses, commercial buses?
Yes, definitely. Both buses carrying passengers for hire and school buses generally have to stop at all railroad crossings, 15 to 50 feet back. They have to listen and look both ways, even if no signals are active, and only proceed when absolutely safe. For school buses, this applies even if the tracks look abandoned or are marked exempt. It's an extra layer of caution because of the passengers.
Okay, let's talk stopping, standing, and parking. We've all seen some questionable parking jobs. What are the rules, especially outside of towns?
Outside a business or residential area, you generally can't stop, stand, or park in the paved or main traveled part of the highway.
Okay, stay off the road itself.
Right. Exceptions are if it's impractical to get fully off the roadway and you leave enough width for other traffic to pass and your vehicle is clearly visible from 200 feet in both directions. Basically, if you can pull completely onto the shoulder, you should.
And what places are just always off limits for stopping, standing, or parking anywhere?
There's a long list. you absolutely cannot stop, stand, or park.
Mm.
Double parked next to an already parked car, on a sidewalk, and an intersection, on a crosswalk, between a safety zone and the curb, near road construction if you'd obstruct traffic, on a bridge or in a highway tunnel, on railroad tracks, where signs prohibit it. These are pretty universal no-go zones.
And there are even more specific rules for just standing or parking, right? What's the difference again?
Standing is halting, but not just temporarily picking up or dropping off passengers. Parking is halting, but not just temporarily loading passengers or merchandise. So for standing or parking, there are distance rules. You can't stand or park in front of a driveway, within 15 feet of a fire hydrant, within 20 feet of a crosswalk at an intersection, within 30 feet of the stop sign, yield sign, or traffic signal on the approach side. Parking is even more restricted, like you can't park within 50 feet of a railroad crossing. These ensure visibility and access.
So many specific distances. And parallel parking. How close to the curb do you need to be?
When parallel parking, your right-hand wheels must be within 18 inches of the right-hand curb or edge of the road.
18 inches, okay.
On a one-way street, you can park next to either curb, but still within 18 inches and facing the direction of traffic. Oh, and interestingly, the owner of an illegally parked, unattended vehicle can be cited, even if they weren't the one who parked it there. Responsibility follows ownership.
Huh. Good to know. All right, speed limits. Seems simple, don't go over the sign. But is it more complex than that?
It definitely is. The fundamental rule is you can't drive faster than is reasonable and prudent under the circumstances. The posted limit is just the maximum under ideal conditions.
The speed limit isn't always the safe speed.
Exactly. Exceeding the posted limit is prima facie evidence. On its face, it's presumed that your speed was unreasonable. That's the basic speeding ticket. But you also have a duty to drive at an appropriate reduced speed when conditions demand it. Approaching intersections or railroad crossings, going around curves, crusty hills, on narrow roads, or when there's a special hazard like bad weather, heavy traffic, or road construction. You need to slow down, even if you're below the posted limit. Failing to do so can be a fail to control speed violation.
What if there's no speed limit sign posted? How do you know how fast you can go?
Good question. The law sets default, or prima facie, speed limits for unposted areas. 30 mph in an urban district, like residential streets in the city. 15 mph in an alley,
yeah.
70 mph on most state highways, U.S. highways, interstates, and farm ranch to market roads outside urban areas, 60 mph on county roads outside urban areas, 60 mph for a school bus on highways, if it has a commercial vehicle inspection, 50 mph otherwise or on local roads, 15 mph on a beach. And generally, trucks, buses, etc. follow the same limits as cars unless posted otherwise.
Are any vehicles totally exempt from speed limits?
Yes, a few. Authorized emergency vehicles responding to an actual emergency call, police patrols at any time, and interestingly, physicians or ambulances responding to an emergency call. But note, a physician responding is exempt from speed limits only. They don't get the other privileges of an emergency vehicle, like running red lights. It's a specific, limited exemption.
Okay, beyond those main categories, what other sort of miscellaneous but important driving rules should people be aware of from Chapter 545?
Well, there's reckless driving. That's operating a vehicle with willful or wanton disregard for the safety of persons or property. It implies a deliberate indifference to safety. It's a Class B misdemeanor, meaning it usually results in arrest, not just a ticket.
Okay, serious stuff. What about leaving your car unattended on a public road?
If you leave your vehicle unattended on a highway, the law says you have to stop the engine, lock the ignition, remove the key, set the parking brake, and turn the wheels to the curb if you're on a hill. This prevents rollaways and theft.
Does that apply in my own driveway?
No. This specific rule doesn't apply on private property, like driveways or private parking lots, only on highways.
Got it. And following emergency vehicles,
yeah.
Fire trucks, ambulances with lights and sirens on, is there a set following distance?
Yes. For fire apparatus and ambulances responding to a call, you cannot follow closer than 500 feet. You also can't drive into or park in the same block where they've stopped for an emergency.
500 feet, that's quite a distance.
It is. And importantly, this 500-foot rule applies specifically to fire trucks and ambulances. The law does not set a specific following distance for police vehicles responding to calls.
Interesting. What about towing? Like one car towing another or towing a trailer?
When towing another vehicle, the drawbar or connection, the chain, strap, whatever, can't be longer than 15 feet between the vehicles. If the connection is longer than 15 feet, which usually shouldn't happen, or if it's a chain or cable-type connection, you need a white flag, at least 12 inches square, attached to it for visibility. Also, you can't tow more than three vehicles behind you using the saddle mount method, where the front wheels of the towed vehicle are on the bed of the towing vehicle.
And safety chains, like between a truck and a trailer.
Yes. Towing safety chains are generally required when a passenger car or light truck is towing a trailer or another vehicle. The requirements are pretty strict. Two separate chains, equal length, strong enough, attached correctly, not dragging, etc. They're meant to keep the trailer attached if the main hitch fails. There are exceptions, though. Things like farm trailers used for agriculture, or trailers with fifth wheel or gooseneck hitches, don't require the same safety chains because their hitch mechanism is different.
Okay. Child safety seats and seat belts, always critical. What are the rules in Texas?
For child safety seats, the rule is children younger than 8 years old must be in an appropriate child safety seat system, according to the manufacturer's instructions.
Younger than eight?
Unless the child is taller than 4 feet 9 inches, if they reach that height, they can use the vehicle's regular seatbelt regardless of age. There are a couple of exceptions. Taxis, ride shares, or if all available seating positions with belts or safety seats are already occupied by other children under eight.
And for older kids and adults, seat belts.
For safety belts, everyone 15 years of age or older must wear one if they're in a seat that's equipped with a belt. This applies to passenger vehicles, which includes cars, SUVs, vans, pickups, even big rig trucks. Tractors.
So if you're 15 or older and not buckled up, you get the ticket.
Correct. The passenger gets cited. The operator of a school bus also has to wear their belt. But here's a twist. Passengers on a school bus are not required by state law to wear seatbelts, even if the bus has them. Why? Because a school bus doesn't fit the legal definition of passenger vehicle for this specific law.
That's surprising. So if a 14-year-old isn't wearing their seatbelt in my car, who gets the ticket? Me or them?
In that case, the driver can be cited for transporting an unrestrained passenger younger than 15. The 14-year-old wouldn't get the ticket themselves. The driver's responsible for minors under 15.
Okay. What about riding in the back of a pickup truck bed? Still allowed?
It's illegal for anyone under 18 to ride in an open pickup bed while the vehicle is moving.
But okay for adults, 18 and over.
Yes, it is legal for someone 18 or older to ride back there. And since there's no seat equipped with a safety belt in the bed, there's no seatbelt violation for them either.
Huh. Okay, one last one in this section. Those fully automated self-driving cars, we're starting to see. Who's legally the driver if there's no human driving?
This is fascinating looking ahead. The law addresses automated motor vehicles. For purposes of traffic laws, the owner of the automated vehicle is considered the operator, even if no one's inside or just passengers.
So the company that owns the robo-taxi is the operator.
Essentially, yes. The automated driving system itself is considered licensed to operate the vehicle. So if a Waymo car runs a red light, Waymo, the owner, could get the citation. These vehicles are also exempt from equipment rules designed for human drivers, like maybe mirrors, if the automated system doesn't need them to operate safely. It really shifts the whole concept of who's in control. Vehicle equipment, keeping your ride compliant.
All right, let's shift gears again and talk about the vehicle itself. What equipment does your car, truck, or motorcycle need to have or not have to be legal on Texas roads? This is Chapter 547 territory.
Exactly. Chapter 547 covers vehicle equipment. First, a really important point. Most of this chapter doesn't apply to things like farm tractors, road construction machinery, bicycles, golf carts, ATVs, things like that, unless a specific rule says it does.
So a tractor doesn't need the same headlights as my car?
Generally, no. These specialized vehicles often have their own different standards. It's a common misunderstanding.
What if a vehicle just seems generally unsafe, even if all the required parts are technically there?
There's a catch-all rule for that. It's illegal to operate a vehicle that's in an unsafe condition, isn't properly equipped, or has a defect that's likely to cause a crash or endanger someone. Case law even supports stopping someone for driving on a completely flat tire if the officer can explain why it was dangerous under the circumstances, like the speed, the road type, etc. It's about overall operational safety.
Okay, lights. What colors are allowed on the back of a vehicle? Red seems standard, but what about other colors people add?
The rule is pretty strict. Unless the law specifically says otherwise, any lighting device or reflector on the rear of a vehicle must be or reflect red.
Must be red.
Yes. The only exceptions are for signals. Turn signals could be red, amber, or yellow. And the white light that illuminates your license plate is okay. But things like an aftermarket white cargo lamp that shines backward while you're driving, that's a violation. Blue or green lights showing to the rear, definitely not allowed, unless part of an authorized signaling system.
What about flashing lights?
We had
red, white, blue strobes. especially on vehicles that aren't police cars or fire trucks?
This is a big area of regulation. Generally, you cannot operate a vehicle with a red, white, or blue beacon, flasher, or alternating light unless that use is specifically authorized by law.
And who is authorized for, say, flashing red lights?
The list is specific. School buses, authorized emergency vehicles, police, fire, ambulance, church buses, and tow trucks under certain conditions, like actively hooking up to a vehicle or at a crash scene directed by police. Highway maintenance vehicles. They typically use flashing amber lights. They might be permitted to use blue flashing lights in some cases by TXDOT standards, but flashing red or white is generally prohibited for them. It's all about clear identification. Red and blue generally means emergency.
Makes sense. Okay, brakes, obviously crucial. What are the requirements?
Every motor vehicle needs service brakes, your main foot brake capable of stopping and holding the vehicle. You also need a parking brake, emergency brake, that works independently of the service brakes and can hold the vehicle still, even on a hill. This doesn't apply to motorcycles or mopeds, though.
What about trailers? Do they need their own brakes?
Yes, depending on their weight. This is based on actual gross weight, remember, not the rating. A trailer weighing over 4,500 pounds gross must have brakes, generally on all wheels. If it's over 15,000 pounds gross, it needs power brakes. For trailers between 4,500 and 15,000 pounds, if you're traveling over 30 mph, brakes are required. Typically, just on the rear axle is sufficient by law, though brakes on all axles are better. The brakes need to match the actual load being stopped.
If a big truck or bus breaks down on the highway, what kind of warning devices do they need to put out?
This applies to large vehicles, 80-plus inches wide or 30-plus feet long. If one stops on the roadway or shoulder, the driver must immediately turn on their vehicular hazard warning lamps, the four-way flashers. If it's disabled outside a city at night or in bad visibility, they also have to set out specific warning devices, usually reflective triangles, sometimes flares in a pattern, behind and in front of the vehicle to warn approaching traffic from a distance.
Okay, let's tackle the big one, window tint. So much confusion here. What are the rules in Texas?
Yeah, this is always a hot topic. Window tint rules are designed to ensure the driver can see out clearly. Generally, you can't put anything on the windshield or front side windows that obstructs or reduces the driver's clear view. However, the law then provides specific exceptions for tint film.
So what is allowed? How dark can you legally go?
Okay, here's the breakdown. Windshield. Tint is allowed above the AS1 line, a line marked by the manufacturer near the top, or down 5 inches from the top if there's no AS1 line. But this windshield tint must allow at least 25% light transmission and can't be red, amber, or blue. Front side windows, driver and front passenger. Tint is allowed here if it meets either of two conditions, at least 25% light transmission or R25% or less light reflectance. Rear side windows and rear window. Here's the surprise for many. The windows behind the driver can be tinted without restriction. They can be as dark as you want, even completely blacked out.
Wow, okay. 25% light transmission for the front sides and the top of the windshield. But the back can be limo tint?
Essentially, yes, as long as the front sections meet the standard.
What if someone needs darker tint for medical reasons, like a sensitivity to sunlight?
That's a specific defense. If the driver or a regular passenger has a documented medical condition requiring extra shielding from the sun, they can get an exemption for darker tint on the side and rear windows, but still not the main part of the windshield. They need a signed statement from a licensed physician or optometrist specifying the person and the medical necessity. They need to have that statement with them in the vehicle.
Good to know. Any other interesting equipment rules we should touch on? Mufflers, mud flaps?
Sure, a few quick ones. Mufflers. Required need to be in good working order to prevent excessive or unusual noise. Muffled cutouts or bypasses are illegal. Emission systems. If your vehicle was made after 1967, the emission system needs to be maintained and working. Visible smoke pouring out for 10 seconds or more can get you sighted roadside. Mud flaps, safety guards. Required on the back of most trucks, trailers, and combinations with four or more tires on the rear axle. They have specific requirements for width, rigidity, and how close they hang to the ground, within 8 inches generally. They're there to stop rocks and debris from hitting vehicles behind you. Radar interference devices. Using a device that actively jams police radar is illegal. But passive radar detectors, those are legal under this section in Texas. They just detect, they don't interfere.
Active jammers illegal, passive detectors. Okay, got it.
Yep.
Six, collisions and reporting. All right, let's move into what happens, unfortunately, when collisions occur. Chapter 550. Where do these laws apply? Just public roads, or does it extend to places like parking lots?
This is a key point, where Chapter 550 differs from some other traffic laws. It has a broader reach. It applies not just on highways and what we defined as public places, but also on roads owned by water control districts, and importantly, on private access ways or parking areas provided for clients or customers by a business.
So the grocery store parking lot, the mall parking lot.
Generally, yes.
Yeah.
Crashes there are subject to these state laws about driver duties and reporting. The main exceptions are purely private residential property, like your driveway, and parking garages or lots where you pay a fee specifically to park or store your vehicle. But most free customer parking lots fall under Chapter 550.
Okay, that's huge. So what are the main duties for a driver involved in a crash? Does it depend on how serious it is?
Yes, the duties escalate based on the severity. Collision involving personal injury or death. This is the most serious, often called fail to stop and render aid felony. The driver must immediately stop at the scene or return immediately if they couldn't stop right away. They have to check if anyone is hurt, provide their information, name, address, registration, insurance, and render reasonable assistance to anyone injured, like calling for an ambulance. Leaving the scene of an injury or fatal crash is a felony, with the severity depending on whether it was an injury, serious bodily injury, or death. And note, case law says your vehicle doesn't even have to hit another vehicle to be involved. If your actions caused the crash and you flee, you could still be charged. But the driver must know a crash occurred.
Okay, that's for injury or death. What if it's just vehicle damage?
Collision involving damage to a vehicle, the misdemeanor version. The driver still must immediately stop or return. They need to locate the other driver and exchange information. If the other vehicle is unattended, we'll get to that. There's also a specific rule here. If the crash happens on a main lane, shoulder, or entrance exit ramp of a freeway in a major metropolitan area and only involves vehicle damage, no injuries, and the vehicles can be safely driven, the drivers are required to move their vehicles out of the travel lanes to a safer location, like the shoulder or off the freeway, before exchanging info. This is to prevent secondary crashes and keep traffic flowing.
Move it if you can. Okay. What if you hit a parked car, an unattended vehicle?
If you strike an unattended vehicle, you have to stop immediately. Try to find the owner right there. If you can't find them, you must leave a written note in a conspicuous place on the damaged vehicle. That note needs your name, address, and the name of your vehicle's owner, if different.
And hitting something else, like a signpost or a fence.
If you strike a structure, fixture, or highway landscaping, you have a duty to take reasonable steps to locate and notify the owner or person in charge of the property. Give them your name, address, and registration number. For hitting unattended vehicles or structures, the penalty depends on the damage amount. Under $200 is usually a Class C misdemeanor. $200 or more bumps it up to a Class B.
Is there a duty to call the police for every crash?
No. This is a common misconception. You are only legally required to immediately report a collision to law enforcement if the crash resulted in injury or death to any person, or if a vehicle involved is damaged so badly it can't be safely driven away.
So minor fender benders with no injuries and drivable cars, no legal requirement to call 911.
Correct. You still need to stop and exchange information, but you don't have to involve law enforcement according to state law for those minor incidents.
What about the officers themselves? When they investigate a crash, what are their duties and limitations?
Peace officers have broad authority to investigate crashes. They can investigate crashes involving injury, death, or property damage of $1,000 or more and file charges based on their investigation, even if the crash happened on property where Chapter 550 might not technically apply for reporting purposes, like maybe private property not open to the public.
So they can investigate almost anywhere to determine fault or violations.
Pretty much. Their investigative authority to file charges is broad. However, there are those two specific locations where a crash is not considered investigable for the purpose of a formal state crash report. Those private residential parking areas and paid parking lots garages.
And when do they have to file that formal report with TXDOT?
An officer is required to file a written officer's collision report, the standard CR3 form, if the collision resulted in injury or death or apparent property damage of $1,000 or more to any one person's property.
$1,000 threshold for damage.
Yes. And they have 10 days from the crash date to submit that report. But this reporting requirement only applies if the crash occurred in one of those locations covered by Chapter 550, highway, public place, business parking lot, etc.
So they might investigate a crash in a private paid garage to see if charges are warranted, but they wouldn't file a formal state crash report for it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It distinguishes between investigating potential crimes or violations and the administrative duty of reporting crashes for state records and statistics. 7. specialized vehicle operations and related laws.
Okay, let's get into some specific vehicle types, starting with lighter ones. Bicycles, mopeds, electric bikes. How does Texas law treat them? Chapter 551, right?
Right, Chapter 551. It mostly covers bicycles operated on a highway or a bike path. Interestingly, mopeds and electric bicycles are generally treated just like bicycles for most traffic laws. The key takeaway.
Yeah.
A person operating a bicycle generally has the same rights and the same duties as a driver of a motor vehicle, unless a law specifically says otherwise or simply doesn't make sense for a bike.
So cyclists need to stop at stop signs, signal turns.
Generally, yes. They have to follow the rules of the road.
Can you ride with no hands or carry your friend on the handlebars?
You actually can ride with no hands unless you're carrying something that prevents you from keeping at least one hand on the handlebars. So carrying groceries might require a hand, but just cruising, technically okay. Carrying passengers, only if the bike is designed for it, like a tandem or with a proper child seat. And definitely no hitching rides by holding onto a moving car or bus. The cyclist commits that offense.
Where are bikes supposed to ride? Always hugged to the right curb.
If a cyclist on a roadway is moving slower than traffic, they generally need to ride as near as practicable to the right curb or edge.
As near as practicable, so there are exceptions.
Yes. They can move away from the right edge when passing, preparing for a left turn if road conditions make the edge unsafe, like debris or potholes. Or, importantly, if the lane is too narrow for a bike and a car to safely share side by side, defined as less than 14 feet wide. Bicycles can also use the improved shoulder freely, and they are allowed to ride two abreast in a single lane as long as they don't impede traffic unreasonably. No more than two side by side, though, unless it's a designated bike lane.
Any age limits for electric bikes?
Yes, specifically for Class 3 electric bicycles, the faster ones that assist up to 28 mph the operator must be at least 15 years old.
What about those Segway-type things, electric personal assistive mobility devices, or EPAMDs?
Right, EPAMDs. Those are self-balancing two-wheel devices. They're generally treated like bikes, too, but with one key difference of where they operate. If a sidewalk is available, an EPAMD must use the sidewalk, not the road, unless just crossing. If there's no sidewalk, then they can use residential streets or highways with a speed limit of 30 mph or less. Sidewalk first, low-speed roads second.
Okay, moving up a step. Neighborhood electric vehicles, or NEVs. These look more like small cars than golf carts.
They are. An NEV is legally defined as a vehicle that can go up to 35 mph, but no faster. The big difference is that NEVs can be fully registered, get regular license plates and stickers, just like a car. They meet federal safety standards for low-speed vehicles.
So if it's registered, where can it drive? Anywhere a car can.
Not quite. Even if registered, an NEV can only be operated on roads with a speed limit of 45 mph or less, and the NEV itself cannot be driven faster than 35 mph, even if the limit is 45.
45 mph limit roads, max speed of 35 mph. Got it. Requires license, registration, insurance like a car?
If it's registered for that kind of general use, yes. Driver's license, registration, insurance are all required. Local cities can also prohibit them on certain roads if they deem it unsafe.
But I thought you could also operate them without full registration, more like a golf cart.
You can. That's the limited operation rule for NEVs. Under this, registration, plates, and insurance are not required. A driver's license is still needed on public roads, though. Limited operation is allowed within a master planned community, like a large subdivision with its own roads, on a public or private beach, or going to a golf course. But only on roads with a 35 mph limit or less during daytime and within 2 miles of where the NEV is usually kept. It's a trade-off. Less paperwork, but much more restricted use.
Okay, now actual golf carts, how do they fit in? Can they get regular plates?
No. A golf cart is defined as being primarily for golf course use. The Texas DMV cannot issue them normal vehicle registration or regular license plates.
But I see them on roads sometimes.
Yeah.
Do they need any kind of plate?
Yes. If a golf cart is operated on a public highway in an approved way, it generally needs to display a special golf cart license plate. It's a specific plate, different from a car plate, and it doesn't expire. The exception, if it's being operated solely within a master planned community, it does not need the golf cart license plate.
So when can you drive a golf cart on a public road?
Generally, only if the city or county has passed an ordinance specifically allowing it on certain streets. And even then, only on streets with a speed limit of 35 mph or less.
Mm-hmm.
If operated under an ordinance, you need a driver's license, you need insurance, and you need that golf cart license plate displayed, unless you're in that master planned community.
Do golf carts also have that limited operation rule like NEVs where you might not need insurance?
Yes, very similar. Golf carts don't need insurance under limited operation. This applies. Within a master plan community, where they also don't need the plate. Or for travel to from a golf course, if it's within 2 miles during daytime, and on roads with a 35 mph or less speed limit.
Okay, so if I'm driving my golf cart on a public road inside a master plan community, 35 mph limit, no golf cart plate. Am I okay?
Based on the source material, yes. Okay. That specific scenario, master plan community, public road equal 35 mph, fits the limited operation exemption where the golf cart plate is not required.
Last category here. Off-highway vehicles or OHVs? Thinking ATVs, UTVs, sand rails, can these ever legally be on a highway?
This is another area with lots of confusion. Off-highway vehicle, OHV, is the umbrella term. While designed for off-road, they can be on public highways, but only in very specific situations. Similar to golf carts, a city or county can pass an ordinance allowing OHVs on certain roads within their limits, but again, only if the speed limit is 35 mph or less. If operating under an ordinance, you need a driver's license, insurance, and an OHV license plate, similar to the golf cart plate.
Any other ways an OHV can be on a road? Crossing highways. Farm use.
Yes. An unregistered OHV can cross a public highway, even one with a higher speed limit, directly at an intersection. And for farm or utility work, an unregistered OHV can operate on a highway, but not interstates, if it's related to that work, like moving between fields or checking utility lines. OHVs also have a limited operation provision, like golf carts and NEVs. They can operate in a master plan community or going to from a golf course within 2 miles daytime, road equal 35 mph.
Yeah.
Under limited operation, insurance is not required for OHVs. But interestingly, the OHV license plate is still required, unlike golf carts in a master plan community. If operated at 25 mph or less, they also need that slow-moving vehicle triangle emblem. The rules are subtly different for each vehicle type. 8, driver responsibilities and enforcement.
Okay, so you've broken one of these rules. What happens next? What's the legal process when an officer pulls you over?
Chapter 543 covers arrest and prosecution.
Okay.
Any peace officer can arrest without a warrant someone they find committing a violation of these traffic laws. Now, arrest here can simply mean conducting the traffic stop, detaining you briefly.
Does that mean they can always search your car just because they stopped you?
No. A search incident to arrest requires an actual custody arrest, meaning you're being taken into custody, usually handcuffed, going to jail. A routine traffic stop where you just get a ticket doesn't automatically grant the right to search the vehicle incident to that stop.
So if I get pulled over and the officer decides to just give me a ticket, what's the procedure?
The officer issues a written notice to appear. That's your citation, your ticket. You'll be asked to sign it. This signature isn't an admission of guilt. It's your written promise that you will appear in court or contact the court to handle the ticket. Once you sign that promise, the officer must promptly release you. They can't hold you just because they gave you a ticket. The notice has to give you at least 10 days to contact the court. If you then willfully ignore that promise and don't show up or make arrangements, that's a separate misdemeanor offense.
Okay. Traffic signs, signals, road markings. Chapter 544. We know we have to obey them, but are there complexities? What if a traffic light is just dark, no lights on at all?
There are definitely details. TXDOT adopts the official Texas Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, TMUTCD, which sets the standards. For a sign or signal to be enforceable, it has to be an official device, properly placed. Tampering with them is also an offense. Now, a traffic light that's completely outed, no lights showing on any signal head, that's a specific scenario the law addresses.
What do you do? Treat it like a green light?
No. You must treat the intersection as if it were controlled by stop signs in all directions.
Like a four-way stop.
Exactly. You have to stop completely, then proceed only when it's safe, yielding right away according to the standard rules for stop signs.
Okay, good to know. And speaking of stop signs, where do you actually stop? Is it right at the signpost?
No, never right at the signpost. This is a very common mistake. The law specifies 3 potential stopping points in order of precedence. 1, stop at the clearly marked stop line painted on the road, if there is one. 2, if no stop line, stop before entering the crosswalk. 3, if no stop line and no crosswalk, stop at the point nearest the intersecting roadway, where you actually have a clear view of approaching traffic. You never stop at the sign. You stop where you're supposed to, based on the markings or visibility. A violation occurs if any part of your vehicle crosses that designated stopping point before you stop.
We keep coming back to the term highway. Most rules apply there. Mm-hmm. How does this affect enforcement on private property versus public roads?
Right. Most traffic offenses in Subtitle C only apply on a highway, the publicly maintained way. This means state traffic laws, like speeding or running a stop sign, generally cannot be enforced by police on purely private property that isn't considered a public place, like a private residential driveway, or maybe a company's employee parking lot not open to the public, or a paid parking garage. However, local governments, cities, counties, can pass their own traffic ordinances for areas within their jurisdiction. These local rules can be more restrictive than state law, but they can't contradict it.
So Walmart can put up stop signs in its parking lot?
Yes, but the police can't ticket you for violating the state stop sign law there, because it's not a highway. Walmart could, however, potentially trespass you from their property for not following their rules. It limits state law enforcement on private property not accessible to the public.
What about fines? Are they ever higher than usual?
Yes. Fines for moving violations committed in construction or maintenance work zones can be doubled if workers are actually present when you commit the violation. The citation has to note that workers were present.
Doubled fines if workers are present.
Okay.
Also, fines are significantly increased for right-of-way violations that result in a crash causing bodily injury or serious bodily injury. Those fines can range from $500 up to $4,000, depending on how badly someone was hurt. It adds extra penalty when failing to yield causes harm.
What if a police officer, or maybe a full crossing guard, waves me through a red light? Do I obey the light or the officer?
You must obey the lawful order or direction of a police officer, a school crossing guard, or an escort flagger directing traffic. Their command overrides the traffic signal or sign in that immediate situation. Disobeying their lawful direction is a Class C misdemeanor.
Okay, financial responsibility, basically. Insurance. Chapter 601. What's the core requirement in Texas? The core requirement, you cannot operate a motor vehicle here unless you have established financial responsibility, the ability to pay for damages if you cause a collision. The most common way is a standard auto liability insurance policy. But the law also allows a few other ways. Getting a surety bond, making a large cash deposit, $55,000 with the state or county, or getting approved for self-insurance, usually only for large companies. But for most people, it means having liability insurance.
Are any vehicles exempt from needing insurance?
Yes, quite a few, actually. Many vehicles operating under temporary permits we discussed earlier. Trailers with an actual or registered gross weight of 7,500 pounds or less. Farm machinery, road building equipment, farm trailers. Vehicles slow enough to require a slow-moving vehicle emblem. And as we mentioned, golf carts, NEVs, and OHVs, when they're operating under those specific limited operation rules, are also exempt from the insurance requirement.
How do you prove you have insurance, if an officer asks? What counts as proof?
You can show your insurance card, a physical card, or an electronic image on your phone is acceptable. You could also show the actual policy document, a written binder from the insurance company showing temporary coverage, or proof of that cash deposit or self-insurance certificate. And importantly, before an officer writes you a ticket for no insurance, they are required by law to first try to verify your coverage through the state's electronic database, the Financial Responsibility Verification Program.
Oh, they check the database first.
They're supposed to, yes. It helps prevent tickets if you just forgot your card but are actually insured.
What if you get a ticket anyway? What are the penalties? And what if you were insured but couldn't prove it?
Operating without proof of financial responsibility is a misdemeanor. The fine for a first offense is between $175 and $350. A subsequent conviction bumps that up significantly to between $350 and $1,000. However, it is a defense to prosecution. If you can later show the court valid proof that you were insured at the time the officer stopped you. If you bring that proof, the charge should be dismissed.
Vehicle size and weight, Chapter 621. Briefly, how wide or long can a vehicle or its load be?
Maximum width. For a passenger vehicle, it's 8 feet 96 inches, including the load. For other vehicles like trucks, it's 102 inches. 8.5 feet, not counting mirrors and safety devices. Loads on passenger cars can't stick out more than 3 inches on the left or 6 inches on the right fender. Maximum height, 14 feet for any vehicle and its load. If you're driving something over 13 feet 6 inches, you're responsible for making sure you clear bridges and overpasses.
And length. How long can trucks and combinations be?
A single motor vehicle, like a straight truck or bus, generally can't be longer than 45 feet. A truck tractor itself has no limit, but the semi-trailer it pulls is limited, usually to 59 feet. A combination of a truck tractor pulling two trailers, a semi-trailer and a pup trailer, has limits on each trailer, usually 28.5 feet each. An overall combination of vehicles, like a car towing a trailer, is generally limited to 65 feet total length. But interestingly, a combination pulled by a truck tractor, like an 18-wheeler, typically has no overall combination length limit in Texas, only limits on the individual trailer length.
Okay. What about loads sticking way out front or back?
Generally, a load cannot extend more than 3 feet beyond the front of the vehicle, or more than 4 feet beyond the rear.
Even if you put a red flag on it?
Correct. Putting a flag or light on an illegally long load doesn't make it legal. The flag light is only required if the load extension is legal, but exceeds certain parameters, like extending 4 feet or more to the rear. There are specific exceptions allowing longer overhangs for certain types of loads, like maybe poles or vehicles being transported.
Motorcycle helmets. Chapter 661. Highly visible issue. Who absolutely has to wear one in Texas?
Protective headgear is required for motorcycle operators and passengers. That's the basic rule. However, there's a major exception for adults. If you are 21 years of age or older, you are exempt from wearing a helmet if you meet one of two conditions. Either you've successfully completed an approved motorcycle operator safety course, or you are covered by a health insurance plan that provides medical benefits for injuries incurred in a motorcycle crash.
So over 21, you need the course or the insurance to legally ride without a helmet?
That's correct. One or the other.
But if you're under 21?
Anyone under 21 years of age is required to wear protective headgear. No exceptions, period. And each person who is required to wear one but doesn't is committing a violation. So an unhelmeted 19-year-old operator and their unhelmeted 19-year-old passenger could both get tickets.
You mentioned DPS guidance on profiling earlier.
Right. It's important context. DPS specifically trains officers on motorcycle operator profiling awareness, reminding them not to judge riders by appearance, no typical biker, but by actions. They explicitly state that assuming any biker not wearing a helmet is breaking the law is wrong, because they get adult exemptions. It emphasizes knowing the actual law.
Disabled parking, Chapter 681. Those spaces are vital. What constitutes a violation?
An offense occurs if a vehicle is parked or standing in a designated disabled parking space, and either. One is displaying disabled plates or a placard, but the person with the disability is not operating or being transported in the vehicle at that time. Two, or it's not displaying any disabled plates or placard at all. The fines are hefty. $500 to $750, plus court costs.
What if the space isn't marked perfectly?
Yeah.
Say the paint is faded or there's no sign.
It's not a defense if the space is still clearly distinguishable as being for people with disabilities, even if the markings aren't perfect. However, there's a provision that an officer may issue only a warning if the space is marked only with paint on the ground and doesn't have the required upright sign with the accessibility symbol. So the sign seems pretty important for full enforcement.
Can you stop briefly in a disabled spot, maybe just to let someone out?
This goes back to the definition of stand. Standing excludes temporarily halting to receive or discharge a passenger. So a quick drop-off or pickup, without lingering, might technically be allowed even without a placard. But parking or waiting there definitely is not. Officers can also seize disabled placards they see being misused and initiate proceedings to revoke them.
Abandoned vehicles, Chapter 683. How long does a car have to sit before it's legally abandoned?
Generally, a vehicle is considered abandoned if it's left unattended, on a public highway right away for more than 48 hours, or on other public property for 48 hours if it meets certain conditions, like expired registration, inspection, no plates. On turnpike projects, the time frame is shorter, just 24 hours. Law enforcement can then take custody of the vehicle and must notify the owner and any lien holders within 10 days.
Okay, nearing the end here. Implied consent and DWI specimen collection, Chapter 724. Very serious topic. What does implied consent mean?
Implied consent is a legal doctrine. It means that simply by driving a motor vehicle in Texas, you are considered to have automatically consented to provide a breath or blood specimen if you were lawfully arrested for DWI or boating while intoxicated, BWI. It's a condition attached to your driving privilege.
But you can still refuse, right? What happens then? Can they force you?
You can refuse the officer's request. However, the law then details circumstances requiring mandatory blood specimens. If you're arrested for DWI-BWI and refuse a voluntary specimen, the officer shall require one if the incident involved a crash where someone else was injured and needed medical transport. The offense was DWI with a child passenger under 15. You have prior convictions for certain serious intoxication offenses like DWIW child, intoxication assault, intoxication manslaughter, or 2+ prior DWIs. Or if a crash resulted in death or serious bodily injury and the officer believes DWI was the cause.
Shall require. But how do they get it if you're still refusing? Do they need a warrant?
Yes, absolutely. This is critical. Even when the law says a specimen is mandatory, the officer cannot force the taking of that specimen unless they first obtain a search warrant from a judge authorizing it.
The only exception is if they can prove legally sufficient exigent circumstances existed, basically. A true emergency where there was absolutely no time to get a warrant before the alcohol evidence dissipated. DPS guidance stresses this is very hard to prove, and obtaining a warrant is almost always required and preferred.
Okay, so mandatory means they must seek a warrant if you refuse, not that they can force it without one.
Correct. And before they even ask you to provide a specimen, they have to read you specific warnings. The DIC 24 statutory warning explaining the consequences of refusing or failing the test, like license suspension. If the suspect is under 17, that warning must be video recorded.
And who can actually draw blood for DWI purposes?
Only qualified medical personnel. A physician, a qualified technician like a phlebotomist, a chemist, a registered nurse, or sometimes an EMT under direct observation. It has to be done in a sanitary place following recognized medical procedures.
Finally, let's end on keeping Texas beautiful. Littering. Health and Safety Code, Chapter 365. What counts as litter?
Litter is defined broadly. It includes decayable waste like food and yard waste and non-decayable solid waste. Paper, glass, plastic, cans, tires, car parts, furniture. Basically trash. It excludes sewage and industrial waste. The illegal act is to dispose and dump, discharge, deposit, spill, or place litter where it doesn't belong, including in someone else's dumpster without permission.
What are the penalties? Does it matter if it's just one cup or a whole truckload?
Yes, the penalties scale dramatically based on the weight or volume of the litter, less than 5 pounds or 5 gallons. Class C misdemeanor, like that single cup, 5 pounds to 500 pounds or 5 to 100 cubic feet. Class B misdemeanor, like dumping a few old tires, 500 pounds to 1,000 pounds, or 100 to 200 cubic feet. Class A misdemeanor, 1,000 pounds or more, or 200 plus cubic feet. State jail felony. Big dumping can lead to serious time.
What if stuff just blows out of your truck bed accidentally? Is that littering?
If it's just accidental, like paper flying out due to wind, despite reasonable efforts to secure it, that's likely not considered illegal disposing and dumping. The law implies some level of intent or negligence in the disposal.
And flicking a cigarette butt.
That is littering, likely a Class C misdemeanor based on weight.
What if it's still lit and starts a fire?
Ah, that changes things. If you discard lighted litter and it actually ignites a fire, the offense becomes a Class B misdemeanor, even if it was just a cigarette butt. The consequence elevates the penalty.
Wow. Okay. That was definitely a deep dive into the Texas Transportation Code. We went from defining a public place all the way to the nuances of automated vehicles and even littering.
We covered a lot of ground. And what's really striking is how detailed and interconnected these rules are. They all work together, trying to create safety and order on roads that are constantly evolving with new technology and challenges. It really makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And maybe leaves you with a question to ponder. Given this complex web of rules, especially around things like driver awareness and responsibility, that culpable mental state we discussed, how will technologies like advanced driver assistance systems or even fully self-driving cars continue to challenge and reshape our legal understanding of who or what is truly responsible when something goes wrong?
That's a fantastic question. Who is the operator with the culpable mental state when the car drives itself? The owner, the programmer. The manufacturer. The law is definitely playing catch up there. We really hope this deep dive today has not only given you some solid information, but also sparked a bit more curiosity about the legal framework that, you know, guides pretty much every trip we take.
Absolutely. Understanding these laws isn't just about avoiding a ticket, right? It's about being a more informed driver, contributing to safer roads for everyone. Even the small rules play a part.
Well said. Thank you so much for joining us on the Deep Dive. We hope you feel more knowledgeable, maybe even a bit more appreciative of the hidden complexities behind the wheel. Until next time, stay curious.